Well, brethren, notwithstanding what Mr. Mackenzie has said, I'm not quite sure why I am standing here. I wondered if the committee had maybe done some research into my murky past and had uncovered one of my sins and faults of youth when I, in my youthful folly, campaigned for the Conservative Party in none other than Maryhill and Partick in Glasgow. If I learned anything in these days, it was how to run quickly, which is not easy to do with a huge blue rosette. And I think I was given a couple of thousand leaflets to distribute to promote our beloved Margaret Thatcher. And I maybe distributed about 50 before I realised that this was not a safe occupation. They went under my bed, and as far as I know, they may still be there. When I was asked to prepare this, I tried my best, and it was only last week, though, I realised that so many of the Irish brethren were going to be here, and I realised that perhaps this was a subject that was maybe not going to be of such interest. So I've tried to jig things around a little bit, and I hope that it will at least be interesting, and I hope also relevant, although I hope you'll excuse me if, for reasons of time, I allow you to make the connections and the applications to your own situation. Sir David Steele, the independent presiding officer of the new Scottish Parliament, said this at its opening: "The advent of the Scottish Parliament is arguably the most significant political development in Scotland for 300 years. It is a tremendous opportunity," he said, "to interest the people of Scotland in issues of citizenship, representation, and democracy. It is also a tremendous opportunity, though, for us to try and interest our own people in the biblical view of citizenship, representation, democracy, and government in general. And I hope that if this address achieves anything, that it will stimulate you to think along these lines and perhaps even address these matters more actively in your ministries. We're all aware of the heresy of many roads lead to God. However, it is a truth that many roads do lead to this subject, the church and parliament in Scotland or any land. And rather than spend our time on one road, I would like to spend a little bit of time on a number of roads that lead to this subject. The first road I would like to look at is the theological road. You might call it the principles. Now, there are two extremes which we can fall into when we're looking at the biblical principles of government. One extreme is to spend all our time studying this matter. And for those of us who spent some time in the Free Church College, you will remember that weeks, if not months, were spent, hour after hour after hour, going through the proof texts, the exegesis of the confession, looking at historical writings on this matter. And it would be very, very easy to spend this hour looking at this subject from that approach. However, what tends to happen if you do that is you do not get on to the practice. And so I would like to try and avoid that extreme. Yes, we shall look at some of the principles, but I hope you'll excuse me if I do not spend so much time giving proof texts, exegeting the confession, and just hopefully communicate to you what I believe are the biblical principles and confessional principles behind this subject without going into all the detail. Another extreme we can fall into is to skip the principles altogether. And in our modern world, where the great cry is for practical Christianity, It is very, very tempting to try and, as it were, leap over the principles and get right down to the nitty-gritty, the practice. However, as I'm sure we're all aware, that any attempt to do that in any area of biblical teaching is doomed to long-term failure. Any attempt to just exhort people without a biblical foundation is doomed to fail in the long term. Interesting though it may be in the short term, we need to undergird it with specific biblical principles. The church and the state then. The Bible teaches us that these are two separate institutions. And I'd like to look first of all at the similarities between them and then look at the differences between them. What does the Bible teach are the similarities between the church and the state? Well, they are both divine institutions. They are both visible organizations. They are both under the headship of Christ. They both should be governed by the Word of God, and they both exist for the glory of God. What though are the differences? There is similarity, but there is not identity. There is overlap, but it's not a total eclipse, as it were. What are the differences between the church and the state? Well, they have different jurisdictions. The church has a spiritual jurisdiction. The state has civil jurisdiction. They have different subjects for their government. The church's subjects are the covenanted people of God. And the state's subjects are every citizen. And of course, there is a little bit of overlap there. They also have different actions that they must aim at. The church's aims must be to worship God, to preach the gospel, to evangelize the lost, to engage in works of charity, and to encourage the government. The government's actions are different. They are to protect its citizens, to administer justice, to encourage the church. It's a two-way thing. Now, some I know argue that the state has no role in encouraging the church. However, everybody, high or low, rich or poor, prime minister or pauper, everybody has a duty to promote true religion, wherever they are, whatever their station in life. They also have different governments. The church is ruled largely by presbyters, elders, with administrative help from the deacons. And the state, of course, is ruled by a number of different officers. And it's interesting that, as far as I can see, the Bible doesn't put its own imprimatur on any specific form of state government, whether it be monarchical, republican, democratic, dictatorial, or whatever. It's interesting that probably democracy arose out of a kind of Presbyterianism seeping into the state. That might be something you want to think about later. They also have different sanctions. The church has only spiritual sanctions to back up its government, whereas the government is given the sword, physical sanctions that can hit you in the body or in the pocket or in some other area where they may damage you personally. That has been given to them by God. So yes, there are similarities, but there are also differences. Now, there are three errors that we can fall into when we're looking at this particular subject. There's the error, of course, of Erastianism, which says that the church is supreme, that the church has authority over the state, the kind of thing we have to a certain degree in the Church of England. Okay. There is, of course, also the what we might call Romanism, where the church has authority over the state and the church is regarded as supreme. And then there is, of course, separatism, the kind of thing we see in America, where the church and the state is regarded as completely independent of one another. We have to try and avoid falling into these errors. So in conclusion, what can we say? Well, perhaps the phrase to best sum up a difficult relationship, that between the church and the state, is this: independent cooperation. It may seem like a contradiction in terms, but in practical terms, that is what it is. Independent cooperation. Good neighbours and good friends. It was Thomas Chalmers who said that the church knocks on the door of government, not in the crouching attitude of supplicants for ourselves, but in the high and firm attitude of donors, saying, "Here is our contribution, what is yours?" That then, in brief, in a very brief outline, is perhaps what you might call the theological approach, the principles behind this relationship. Another road we could take into this subject is what you might call the past, the historical approach. We could spend much time reflecting on how the present relationship between the church and the parliament has come about in Scotland. We could trace the sequence of events leading up to the establishment of the first Scottish Parliament for 300 years. We could also perhaps spend some time looking at the flashpoints between church and state over these 300 years and try and derive some lessons from that, and there have been many flashpoints. We could also look perhaps at the historic legal obligation of the state to support the church as enshrined in the Act of Union. This was a subject that Professor Hugh Cartwright made a substantial study of and came to the conviction that the Act of Union, as long as it remains in force, and it still does, enshrines Reformed Presbyterian religion as the religion the state must support. It was interesting that when an overture on this was presented to the General Assembly, that it was opposed. One of the reasons that it was opposed was, you know, the idea was to overture the Scottish Parliament to recognise Reformed Presbyterian religion as the religion of the state, the one to be supported, and excluding all others. When that was presented, one of those who opposed it said that Donald Dewar knew all these things already. This was somebody who claimed to know Donald Dewar personally. But whether he knew it or not, it certainly doesn't seem to have had any impact. I believe that far from this government being historically literate, it is, as somebody once described modern man, he has his feet firmly planted in mid-air. No knowledge or understanding where he has come from, no knowledge or understanding of where he is going. And for that reason, I've decided to take an editorial decision, as it were, and not spend so much time here today on the history. We are in an era when our government, indeed most people, have little or no interest in history, and any interest that there is, it doesn't seem to translate into present application. It may be an interesting subject out there, but it has no relevance to us today. Now, of course, as Christians, we disagree with that, but we have to face up to the fact that this is the situation we are in. And so, in order to try and derive the maximum edification out of this period we have together, I've decided to spend no time in discussing this. However, there is a handout at the end of this, which I've called The Beginner's Guide to the Scottish Parliament. And in it you'll find there, if you're interested, a sequence of events relating the history leading up to the establishment of the Scottish Parliament. The past. A third road we could take into this subject is what I might call the party political approach. I'm sure we've all heard Christians trying to argue that a certain political party is the Christian party, that its philosophy and its policies are Christian and that all others are not. Now, it would be perhaps a very interesting time for me to stand here and try and offer a biblical critique of the Conservative Party's capitalism, the Labour Party's socialism, the Liberal Party's liberalism, and the Scottish National Party's nationalism. And I believe it's possible to offer a biblical critique of these four political philosophies. But I think it would be futile in the present day to try and argue that one of these parties was the Christians' party. Any fair-minded person, I'm sure, looking at our present-day situation, would have to conclude that they are miles away from the Bible. They are utterly secular. And any attempt to promote one above the other as more Christian than the other, I think would only end up in a political controversy between us rather than spiritual edification. So again, I would like to eschew that approach and spend little or no time on that road. The fourth road that I would like to take you on, though, is what I might call the common grace road. Perhaps you might call it the positives. What do I mean by this? Well, I believe that God, in his mercy, gives gifts to men. I believe that God in his mercy restrains wickedness. And that God in his mercy gives us government for the good of his own people. And I believe it would be arrogance of the church to sit back and say, we have nothing to learn from non-Christians. And we have nothing to learn from the way in which non-Christian organisations work. I believe it is right and proper for us to listen and to learn from even non-Christians and non-Christian organisations. And I hope I can prove that in the following minutes. One of the things we have to recognise, one of the positives in our elected representatives, at least in some of them, is this. There is a genuine desire to do good. There is a genuine desire to work for the benefit of the nation. The Reverend Graham Blunt, who has been appointed the first Scottish Church's parliamentary officer, has remarked on this frequently, at how surprised he has been in dealing with the various MSPs at what he believed was their real and genuine and wholehearted desire to do good. Oh yes, there are the freeloaders, there are the self-promoters, but there are those who do have a genuine desire to work for the benefit of the Scottish people. And that, I believe, is a gift from God. We also can listen and learn from the way in which government is working. One of the areas where there were many fears as to how it would work would be the relationship between the UK government and the Scottish Executive. And so one of the first things that was done was this. Civil servants and MPs from both parliaments sat down and they drew up what they called a memorandum of understanding, which was to regulate the way in which these two possibly competing bodies, two bodies which may have different interests and aims, would work together nevertheless. And the principles are most interesting, and indeed, I believe, have a tremendous application in our own dealings with one another, and especially in the way our church courts work, different court sessions with one another, and with superior courts, etc. There are five principles outlined in this memorandum, undergirding and guiding this possibly troublesome and confrontational relationship. The first one was this: good communication. The second one was cooperation. The third one was exchange of information. The fourth one was this, and very important today, confidentiality. And the fifth one, a word that we'll come back to again and that occurs a lot in political talk today, it's this: accountability. These are five principles helping secular organisations to work better together, and yet I believe they are five biblical principles which should also guide and direct the operation of different courts, one with another, and Christians, one with another. And we can listen and we can learn, because we can be easily put to shame by the way these non-Christians work compared with ourselves. Another area we can learn from, some positives from this Parliament. Before the Parliament was set up, the Labour government set up what was called the Consultative Steering Group, and it was to outline certain principles to govern the way the Scottish Parliament worked in itself, not in relationship to others, but in itself. And it promoted four principles, again, which I believe have an impact upon us and an application for us in our own church government, and would be of great benefit to us if we practiced them more commonly. The first principle that was to undergird all workings was this: sharing the power. One of the aims, especially of the method of election, proportional representation, at least an element of it, was to ensure that no one party would dominate. And that principle has been outworked in different ways throughout the Parliament. For example, there is an independent presiding officer. There is an all-party business committee, taking in from every single party and excluding none. The committees themselves must reflect the sharing of the power between the different parties, and the committee's convenerships are also shared out proportionately between the different parties. They talk, of course, of the importance of sharing the power between the people of Scotland, the Scottish Executive, and the Scottish legislators, the MSPs, and of course leave out the great giver of the power. And I'm not saying that these are perfect principles, and I'm not saying that the application of them is perfect in any way, but I do still believe there are positives there that we can recognise, that we can praise, that we can give credit for, and that we can learn from, sharing the power. Then secondly, there was accountability. As I've said already, a word that occurs time and time again. And the reason is this: what was the later years of the Conservative Party largely characterised by in Westminster? It was unaccountability. Nobody seemed to take responsibility. Nobody seemed to be accountable for their behaviour. They drowned in a sea of sleaze. And so when they were setting up this new Parliament, one of the great things they wanted to do was introduce accountability, that the Executive would be accountable to the Parliament, and they say the Parliament and the Executive would be accountable to the people of Scotland. Again, they leave out God, I admit. But still, I believe the Bible teaches that we are to be accountable one to another, that we are to submit ourselves one to another. Yes, it adds in the fear of God, and we'd like to see that, but even half of it is better than none of it. And there is a strong desire in this Parliament that the elected representatives be much more accountable to those who have elected them. And indeed, we've seen a number of times in the workings of their committees that there's a strong desire to introduce far more accountability for Scottish public bodies, quangos as they call them. And this can only be of benefit to the Scottish nation, that people are being called to account. People have to face up to the fact that they'll get a grilling if they fall foul of certain standards. So there is accountability. There is also this principle, participation, openness. One of the great characteristics of Westminster government was its closed system. It was almost impossible to get inside, to get communication in. It seemed to be so isolated and distant. And again, they wanted the Scottish Parliament to be open, to be accessible, to involve the people of Scotland. This gives great opportunities. There are far more opportunities for you and I to represent our interests and concerns and to press our agenda in Scotland than there ever was in Westminster. They have a public information service. They have an education service. They have a visitor centre. Everything geared to making it open and accessible. And the Parliament's workings are very much focused on making them understood, modern, efficient, clear, plain, simple. The committees meet in public. The committees travel the country, trying to bring government to the people and to try and get the people interested in government. Family-friendly hours of the Parliament, helping to boost the family lives, crucial for our MSPs. Creche facilities provided and things like that. The final principle the Consultative Steering Committee set out was this, equality. I'd like to come back to that because I believe while there are positives in it, there are also great dangers. But they set out that the Scottish Parliament had to promote equality in all its appointments and operations. Again, to try and get away from this idea of an elite, of a club, of prejudice, of vested interests, that there should be equal opportunities for all. So there are principles there in the Consultative Steering Group's report that I believe too are from God. They are to be welcomed and we should be thankful for them insofar as they help the climate, the moral climate of our land. But one of the other things that I believe is a positive is, again, one of the first things the MSPs did was they published a code of conduct, something again that was totally lacking in Westminster until recently. And the first sentence in this code of conduct runs something like this. The Scottish electorate will have high expectations of their MSPs and their behaviour. And the MSPs have a high responsibility to exceed those expectations because they have a key role in addressing the public disillusionment and cynicism with the political process. It's interesting that the mace that was made for the Parliament and is a symbol of its authority has one word inscribed on it, and it's this: integrity. Integrity. And this is again a deliberate attempt to distance this Parliament from the precedents in Westminster. The code of conduct set out certain principles again that MSPs had to familiarise themselves with and put into operation. Public duty. That's what they were there for, to serve the public. not themselves. Selflessness. Again, it emphasised integrity. It emphasised honesty. Openness. Again, accountability. And finally, and perhaps most significantly, leadership. Leadership. You'll remember in the latter days of the Tory government, it was often said politicians' private lives have nothing to do with the public. And here there is some recognition at least that MSPs, elected representatives, do have a leadership role. They must regard themselves as examples and tailor their behaviour accordingly. Leadership. And it's interesting, anyone can read this code of conduct. It's on the Scottish Parliament website. And indeed, it's a very challenging document, even for the Christian. And if we were to put some of its principles into operation in our own lives, we would find it very challenging. Some of the rules that are set out to govern the way, for example, they are to treat one another, MSPs, the way they are to treat other staff in the Parliament, the way that they are to declare vested interests and things like that. The code of conduct is a positive and to be welcomed. Even the legislation that was proposed in the first year of the Parliament has many commendable things in it. The Land Reform Bill, designed to give especially Highland communities the right to buy the land on which they live and work. The abolition of feudal tenure, which abolished the rights of feudal superiors over land that they never even owned. There's the Ethical Standards in Local Government Bill, again to address sleaze. Tragic that the repeal of Section 28 was tagged on to the bill called Ethical Standards in Public Life. But notwithstanding that, it sets out a Scottish Standards Commission to ensure that our councillors are not corrupted, that they are operating according to certain high standards. There's a transport bill to ease congestion in our roads, an incapable adults bill designed to help those who can no longer help themselves, an education bill designed to raise standards in our schools and to try and address the serious problem of underperforming and undisciplined schools. And I know it may seem a wee bit dry and dusty, and it may seem like scraping the surface of many of our problems, these bills, but I believe it is our duty to recognise, even in these weak attempts, an attempt to do good for the people of Scotland, an attempt to improve public social life in Scotland. The new bills have just been published for the next year of Parliament, and again, they include some commendable legislation. There's an evidence bill which is designed to stop rapists cross-examining their victims in the courts and to set certain safeguards even on lawyers' questionings of victims in court. That's commendable. There's a water bill to try and prevent cowboys operating for profit in the water industry and ruining water quality. There's an International Criminal Court Bill, which is intended to try and address the increasingly international dimension of crime. A number of things like that, which again we must thank God for, I believe, and even praise our MSPs for. And who knows? We might get more of a hearing if we perhaps were praising a little bit more and condemning a little bit less. There is then the common grace road, the positives. But I'd like to come fifthly to the what I would call the prophetic road, maybe one we are more familiar with ourselves. Of course, our model for this is the prophet Jeremiah. He was given a commission by God, See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down and to build and to plant. Jeremiah was given a twofold prophetic commission. It was to be both destructive and constructive. And we are given that mission too. We mustn't, of course, be all about the positives. That would be compromise. We must also speak the truth about our government's failings. And that again is a note that has become largely silent in our land. What are we to say to the government? Well, in a destructive way, as Jeremiah was told, the rooting out, the pulling down, the destroying and throwing down, we're to turn to our government and say, you are doing wrong. To the highest in our land, to the most powerful and the most influential, you are doing wrong. One of the reasons given for the rejection of that overture I mentioned recently was that this kind of negative approach would get no hearing. It would ruin our case rather than help it. That there was to be no critical note sounded. Well, that is politically correct, but it's biblically wrong. We are to root out, we are to pull down. And if we were to turn to Donald Dewar and his ministers today, what would we say to him? Where is he going wrong? Where are the MSPs dishonouring God? Well, there are a number of areas where we could say to them, you are sinning against God. A third of all MSPs refuse to take the oath to God at their induction and instead preferred a secular affirmation of loyalty to the Parliament and the people of Scotland. Right at the very beginning, God dishonoured, God rejected by a huge swathe of Parliament. One of the first decisions they took the Parliament was concerning daily prayers. And it's one of the saddest things to read in all the minutes of the Parliament. They're all available on the Scottish Parliament website. It's one of the saddest things to read that debate. The jollity of it, the laughing, the joking. And not one voice raised, not one, to say this should be exclusively Christian. The words used continually and the words that have formed the finding are these: interfaith, ecumenical, inclusive. We now have not even daily prayers, but once a week, 4 minutes maximum. Interfaith, proportionate to each faith in Scotland's numbers of adherents. Space also to secular humanism, again in proportion to their adherents and supporters in Scotland. God dishonoured, right at the beginning. We also, of course, have to point again and again to Section 28's repeal, the section which prevented the promotion of homosexuality in schools as a pretended family relationship, repealed, that great wall of protection taken away, and watch the flood come in of perversity and iniquity into our children's ears. There is also this issue I mentioned already of equality. The equality, if you read again the founding documents of the Parliament, one of the things it says is that equality is not to be the work of one committee or of certain MSPs, but is to be mainstreamed into the whole of Parliament. It is to be reflected in all the committees and all its workings and all its appointments. Now, the equality movement began in some ways with good motives, to remove prejudice, to remove much unfairness to try and remove, as it were, the old school tie network and things like that. And it began with equality between the colours of people. No complaints there. It went on to equality, gender equality, and then it began to get a bit dodgy. There were good things in that, but also doors were opened for much evil, the feminization of men and the manning of women. And the equality movement went on to talk not just about equality between the genders, between the colours of people, but then between religions. And now we're at the stage of morals. You see, the door was opened, and what's coming in like a flood? That all are equal, all perversities are equal, all morals are equal. There is none to be placed above another, as was it Sarah Boyack or Wendy Alexander said. We must abhor the idea that there is a hierarchy of morals. And we must turn to this government and say equal opportunities, much of that good. Equality, very wrong. It's one thing to give equal opportunities to people in applying for jobs and things like that. It's entirely another to equalise all religions, all skills, all talents, all morals. And this is a fundamental weakness running through our whole Parliament's operation. There is also, of course, the continuing murder of unborn infants in the womb. A power reserved to Westminster. Why? Because of a fear that were it given to Scotland, it might well be repealed because of the Catholic vote. And we have to insist and demand that this power be given back to Scottish people. Okay, it may not be repealed, but wouldn't it be wonderful if it was? Hundreds and thousands of unborn infants slaughtered. How many even today? So many areas we could turn to our government and say, you are doing wrong. But perhaps the greatest of all is this. The whole idea of the state as saviour. That is what is communicated by most political life today. The state is the saviour. The state government is the answer to all our problems. Individually, families, schools, society, business. Wherever we look, the government must do it. The government has the answer, and if it fails, the government's to blame. One of the things we must insist upon is that the government reduce its size. When we read through the scriptures, what is government given? It's given the sword. And that's about it. To punish evildoers, and to protect and reward the good. Our government today has its tentacles in every area of life, invading areas that belong to the family, invading areas that belong to the church, and we must demand continually that the state retreat and do its own job and leave the job that belongs to the family to the family. Individuals to individuals, and the church to the church. But we mustn't only say in a destructive way you're doing wrong. We must also say you are being judged already. It's not just that judgment will come. Judgment is here. And if there's anything that has characterised this Parliament, it is utter chaos from day one. You read even the secular books on the first year of the Parliament, and there's a recognition that it was a disaster of a year. It began with the Ruddle scandal, where a convicted psychopath was released into the Scottish public through a legal loophole. There was the European Convention of Human Rights fiasco, where Hundreds of temporary sheriffs had to be suspended because of an unforeseen difficulty with enshrining that in our law. There was the resignation of Donald Dewar's chief of staff, John Rafferty, having lied to the media. The resignation of Philip Chalmers, one of his most favoured special advisers on drink-related and immorality-related offences. There was the resignation, of course, of Lord Hardy, hardly even a year into the job, on the eve of the most important trial that there's ever been in Scottish history. There was the resignation even of Alex Salmond, and there's a huge story behind that that is yet to be told to the Scottish public. There's the First Minister's ill health. There's the exams fiasco. There's the buildings debacle, which has risen in cost from 40 million to 200 and rising towards 300 million within a year. I was speaking recently at a wedding to one of the press officers to the Scottish Executive. He represents three of the Cabinet Ministers. And he spoke of how this Parliament began with probably the greatest amount of public goodwill that there's ever been behind a Parliament. And the Executive know that in 1 year they've blown it all. That they're drowning in a sea of public cynicism and disillusionment. Cardinal Winning was right in many ways. It has been an utter failure. And we must turn to our government and say, you're doing wrong, and here are the results. You are being judged already. Repent. Turn from your evil ways. But there's also a constructive element to the prophetic. Jeremiah was told to build and to plant. This is our agenda. That might be something you want to discuss. It's all very well to say this is wrong, that's wrong, this wrong and that is wrong. But government would be well in their place to turn around and say, well, what would you do? And you know, when you get down to it, it's actually very difficult. But if we want anything, surely it's this. We want God honoured. We want God recognised. That can't be done by law. It can only be done by preaching the gospel, getting the gospel out, bringing the gospel somehow before our elected representatives and demanding that they kiss the Son, lest they perish in his ire. We want Sabbath observance protected in law. We want marriage protected and promoted in law. We want Christian education provided by the state, at least partially funded. What else? So many other things. We want the state to retreat. We want the law of the land brought into line with the law of God. We must be constructive. We must build. We must propose. We must plant. We must promote an agenda. But let me come sixthly to the practice. How do we go about this? It's all very well to have the theory, but how can we put it into practice? Well, again, in the handout you'll find a number of areas where I've tried to outline the practice and areas where we can perhaps pursue, and if we could just briefly summarise them in the remaining time. There is, of course, our MSPs, all our elected representatives. Every Scottish citizen now has 18 elected representatives. We have one Westminster MP, we have one constituency MSP, we have 7 list MSPs, we have 8 MEPs. And I think it would be an important task of any minister in a congregation to have a list of these, representing his own people, in order that when issues come up, people can go to a notice board, get the address, get the name, and pursue it. It is our MSPs. There's also our committee system in this Parliament, and you'll find a lot in that in the handout. There's no second chamber in the Scottish Parliament like the House of Lords. Instead, we have a very important committee system which can propose and initiate legislation. And again, I think it would be an important task of any minister in Scotland to have a list of these committees that are there, and a list of their conveners, and to follow the work of these committees, and to contribute to the work of these committees, to be writing, to be lobbying, because I can assure you, every other group under the sun is doing it. There's also a new area for us, that of public petitions. Again, many details in there. We didn't have this option at Westminster, but now we have the option of actually petitioning our government. And every petition must be received by the Parliament, and it must be responded to by the Parliament. Let us be petitioning. You can be rest assured, every perverse group under the sun is petitioning that Parliament. They were 250 in the first year. Why can't we? There's much guidance on how they should be written, again there and on the Scottish Parliament website. There's the Civic Forum, which the Scottish Executive has now authorised, which is a gathering together of different trade unions, churches, voluntary organisations, business organisations, to work alongside the Parliament, to try and again involve the public. There are over 650 groups already registered an interest in becoming part of the Civic Forum, a pre-legislative forum for discussion. Have we registered an interest? There's also the Scottish Church's Parliamentary Office, details again in the handout. And it's set up by certain churches to help churches interact with the Parliament, promote their agenda. It briefs politicians from the churches, and it brings briefings from the politicians to the churches. And as Mr. McKenzie mentioned in his prayer, there are national organisations like National Vala, CARE, the Christian Institute, Evangelical Alliance perhaps, the LDOS, all these lobbying, organising, promoting the Christian agenda, which should be supported in a practical way. But seventhly and finally and very briefly, let me come to the preaching. The preaching. The principles, the past, the party politics, the positives, the prophetic, the practice. But what about the preaching? What can we do in the pulpit? Well, of course, we must preach respect for our democratic institutions. And it's very easy when we see the wickedness in so much of what's going on, when we see the futility in many ways of pursuing the Christian agenda, it's very easy to despise those who are elected to represent us, to decry them continually. It's also easy to be infected by the rebellious spirit of the age that fights against all authority and despises all who are over us. And the minister of the gospel must preach, as was read in Romans 13, that the powers that be are ordained of God. And whosoever resists the power resists the ordinance of God. We must also preach and help people, teach them to discern better. Teach them to question, to analyse what is coming out in the media and from the Parliament. To have their senses exercised between, that they might be able to tell the difference between good and evil. We must preach prayer. 1 Timothy chapter 2, pray for all who are in authority over you. How often have you prayed in the pulpit for your MSP by name? Your MP by name? Is that not something we should be doing? And therefore that will flow into people's private prayers as well. We must encourage prayer. We must also teach people the importance of getting involved in politics. Can we not encourage people in front of us to pursue an interest. Everybody else is. Everybody that's promoting evil is at it. Why shouldn't the Christians be at it as far as we possibly can? Not the ministers, but the people. Have you ever thought that in front of you might be a future MSP? Future First Minister? It's possible. And his conduct and his agenda will depend largely on what he hears from you. Let us identify preaching opportunities. This isn't bringing politics into the pulpit. It's bringing the Bible into politics, which I don't think is wrong. I think it's right. Can we not preach the biblical view of what is an MSP? What are his duties before God? What is a voter? What are his duties before God? The biblical view of justice, of education, of health, of work, of the Sabbath day, of alleviating poverty, of savings and taxation, the biblical view in family, the biblical view in church-state relationships, the biblical view in sport, the biblical view of culture and arts, the biblical view in the environment, and the biblical view on what is real media reporting, the importance of truth. There are so many areas there. Can we not make it our objective to bring the Bible into Scottish politics, even in our own little corners? May God bless these few thoughts to us.